Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Okay, good day, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with another installment of The Voice of Christian Israel. And today we're going to continue with part two of the history of the house of Judah after the Babylonian captivity. And last week I stressed that the Judahites, the house of Judah, that returned from the Babylonian captivity in no way, shape, or form introduced any innovations onto the Mosaic Law. That's absolute nonsense. I know the Jews have been teaching this. I'm going to go into Rabbi Wise's deceptive statement in great detail today. But last Sunday I detailed the history of the Maccabees and how they tried desperately to retain their race, culture, religion, etc., even though Judah was being attacked by, you know, first by the Persians, although the Persians were actually friendly toward Judah. And then later on, the Greeks and then the Romans attacked. And of course, the house of Judah was surrounded on all sides by Edomites, Samaritans, and Arabs, Sepharvaim and Babylonians and all those kind of people. At all times, the house of Judah strove to remain separate and distinct from all these surrounding nations. And that is not what you perceive from traditional historians and traditional Bible scholars, because they don't detail this history. So it's very important to know the history of the intertestamental period. And so I'm going to finish up today, part two of that whole story, and give a lot more details that are very much important to know about that story. Of course, I don't want to leave out the fact that it was the Herodians who were Edomites, Antipater and Herod, who were the ones who usurped the crown of Judah, with Herod actually assassinating Hyrcanus II, who is, I believe, the grandson of John Hyrcanus, and finally took over. He took over by assassination. He was an Edomite. He was not a Judahite by any means, okay? And that has to be understood. And all historians and scholars know this, but they always fail to bring it out because they want you to believe that the Jewish people are the Israelites and Judahites of the Bible, and that there was somehow a smooth transition from the house of the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, toward the Jews, the Herodians, okay? And that's absolutely not the case. So first, a few announcements here. Number one, I just want to announce to everybody my website, which is www.anglo-saxonisrael.com. My contact info is, there's an email address in the contact info on that website. And also, my mail address is ANP, which stands for American National Publishing, Post Office Box 411373, Chicago, Illinois, 60641-1373. We have three books available. One is The Great Impersonation, which is my historical survey of the Old Testament and into New Testament times, detailing the animosity, the enmity between Yahshua Messiah and the scribes and Pharisees, who are today known as Jews, folks. This is the only book ever written that details the separate and distinct histories of the Israelites versus the Jews. They're not the same people, and this book proves it. Okay, and that's $37 postpaid. Check or money order either made to me, Eli James, or to ANP will be good too. We also have for sale Pastor George Udvari's Christian Israel Bible Reference Manual. That's available for $35, and that is also a 2-C-line document. And then Clay Douglas and I co-authored a book called Mystery Babylon, The New World Order Unveiled, and that's available for $30. And Clay Douglas called me this morning. He's very depressed, because it seems like the attacks upon him have been increasing lately. The show I did with him Wednesday morning, he said there was a black helicopter flying over his trailer while he was doing the show. And then he went out to a bar for a couple of drinks. And I guess I forget how he described it, but I guess you pay $10. And you draw a card, and whoever draws the right card can win $100 or $500, whatever. It's a small-time gambling thing at the bar. So he bought $10 ticket, and then he went to play the game, and the guy who was running the game told him to get out. Boy, you know, that's really mean. Is he a Negro or a Jew or something that somebody would just tell him to get out? He paid his $10, right? And so, a brawl nearly ensued. If you know Clayton Douglas, you could anticipate that. But he decided to keep his cool, and he went back to the bar and said, "I want my money back because they won't let me play the game." Okay. So he called me up and said, "What the heck's going on? You know, all the people that used to be his friends and associates are turning against him." And I told him, "Well, that's what happens when you become Christian Identity." So start reading Psalm 91. You're going to lose all your friends because you'll find out who your real friends are. Okay. And so anyway, I told him, start reading your Bible, Clay. You know, if you want to be Christian Identity, you got to start reading your Bible and start with Psalm 91, because it sounds to me like you're going to need protection. Okay. And so we're going to pray for him today as well. And we're going to keep him in mind when I read Psalm 91. Okay. Also, any donations, if you can spare a few shekels for this ministry, again, my P.O. box is ANP, Post Office Box 41-1373, Chicago, Illinois, 60641-1373. And I want to thank all those who have been contributing to this ministry. It makes life a whole lot easier for me. And also, I want to apprise you of William Fink's website, Christogonia.org, where also has links to Clifton Emmaheiser's work and the new Ensign Internet magazine, which has been coming out monthly. I don't know if they're doing that on a regular basis, but always very good issues. Christian Identity, based in England. Okay, so that's also very, very good stuff. Okay, now for today, I want to start by reading Psalm 91, and this is for not just for Clay Douglas, but for all of those in Christian Identity who really need protection, because the enemy is aware of us. The enemy does not like what we're doing on the internet, does not like what we're putting out in written form and in verbal form. But in my opinion, we put them in a bind, because if they come after someone like me, some prominent identity minister, they actually will play their, you know, expose themselves that they don't believe in freedom of speech, that they are in fact worse than we are, because they're the ones who are full of hate, not us. And so if they try to come after a prominent identity minister at this stage of the game, they will simply be verifying what we say about them, okay, that they're tyrants, that they are opposed to freedom of speech, they don't care about the Constitution, and they don't care about America. They're internationalists, they're the enemies of this country, and they don't want to drag anybody into court who's going to say things like this. They don't want that kind of exposure. So right now they're playing it cool. They got a hands-off attitude toward those of us who are promoting this message. But they're going after as many people, you know, out there as they possibly can. I'm going to read a letter. In fact, before I read Psalm 91, let me read a letter I just got from a prisoner who is in the Oregon prison system. Dear Pastor Eli, I received your note along with the card of protection for soldiers and sailors, and of course that is Psalm 91, on the 26th of January. I received two previous letters from you and notification that your letters came in and were rejected. One was in November and one was in early December. I have not received any letter or notification that any was rejected since then till this note from you on January 26th. So what I did, instead of including any literature, any identity literature, I simply wrote him a letter telling him that everything I try to send you keeps coming back. They won't deliver it to you. The last two letters that I have received notice for violation, one for the True Children of Israel and then one for your newsletter. Both were violated or considered violations for racial, racist, derogatory content, slander, and furthering criminal activity. Okay, so this is what the Oregon State prison system considers to be Christian identity literature. Let me repeat, they call it content slander, racist derogatory, and furthering criminal activity. I appealed both violations, and they were both upheld by the supposed impartial administrator. A couple of the things that were highlighted as being slanderous were Revelations 2:9 and 3:9. So quoting the Bible, folks, quoting the Bible is considered slanderous and racially derogatory, where it speaks of the Jews as the offspring of the devil. Okay, so you can't quote the Bible anymore, at least not in the Oregon State Prison System. The unofficial stance of this institution is that they will reject all identity literature and material due to its racial outlook. A friend of mine enrolled in the Bible course provided by the American Institute of Theology, a part of the Kingdom Identity Ministries, and it was also rejected en masse for racial content. It seems that there are some Zionist-loving degenerates censoring our mail who are completely ignoring RLUIPA, which is the federal standard that no racist material can be censored. Okay, it's federal law, which of course the state of Oregon is ignoring. I apologize for the trouble it has caused by wasting postage. I do greatly appreciate your time and what you do. I will close this for the time being. You take care and stay positive. God bless you, Joshua. So this is what's happening in our prison system. We know the Jews are clamping down on freedom of speech. You cannot criticize the hoax cost. And anything that we say in defense of our own race is considered hate literature. Okay? This is what they're trying to do, and they're tightening the screws, but it's not just on us. We're kind of the, the bird in the mine, okay, that they're trying to go after us, and to the extent that they're stifling our racial heritage and our attempts to preserve it, we're, of course, in the front lines, and what they're doing to us, they intend to do to all Americans. There's simply no doubt about this. It's just that the Judeo-Christians are too blind to see it. They think that the that we're extremists and therefore we deserve to be censored. But of course, the aim is to censor them too, because the Jews don't care at one whit for Christianity, for Judeo-Christianity. They're just exploiting the Christian Zionists, taking their money and using it to promote that racist state of Israel, okay? That Jewish racist state of Israel. And unfortunately, the people in this world today are still too blind, especially Christians, are still too blind to see reality. Okay, now I'm going to quote Psalm 91 on behalf of the Oregon State Prison System and for those prisoners I've been trying to contact there, and for Clay Douglas and for all of us in Christian identity. Psalm 91. He that dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of Yahweh, He is my refuge and my fortress, my Elohim. In Him will I trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings shall you trust. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flies by day, nor for the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor for the destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you behold and see the reward of the wicked. Because you have made Yahweh, which is my refuge, even the Most High, your habitation, there shall no evil befall you, neither shall any plague come near your dwelling, for He shall give His angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. They shall bear you up in their hands, lest you dash your foot against a stone. You shall tread upon the lion and the adder, the young lion and the dragon shall you trample under feet, because He has set His love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name, which is Yahweh, folks. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him, and I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. This is Psalm 91, folks. This is the prayer of soldiers' protection. And during World War One, it was Regiment 91 of the British Army. I forget exactly if that's that, or Brigade 91. I forget what the exact title was. But the leader of that brigade had his troops recite Psalm 91 every single day of World War One when they were in the field, and not a single soldier of that brigade lost his life in that whole period of time. So, folks, this prayer works. It is Yahweh's prayer of protection that we should all be reading, because the times are getting very, very dangerous. They're getting very, very dangerous. And now I have also a couple of more letters I wish to read from. And this is from James, a person who's kind of new to identity, but he is appreciating the message that we're delivering. Pastor James, thank you for taking time to open this email. Since finding your newsletter and reading many of the articles plus other websites and many books during the past 35 years, I am becoming most disillusioned with American Christianity. What has happened to the leadership of Christianity in this country during the past century? What kind of religion is this that disregards its culture, government, laws, finances, and keeps a blind eye out for its enemies? Where did these stupid men come from? Who put them into their positions of leadership? The rank-and-file churchgoer has no clue that the enemies of true Christian beliefs and our freedom to practice those beliefs in our culture every day have taken control of our society. The Christian leadership have taken the watchman off the wall. These fools don't even mention the enemy to those who go to church. The enemy is inside the gates and raining havoc among the people, and the people have not a clue that the enemy exists. It seems that focusing on church with all its activities is all that is needed to maintain our Christian culture in America. Well, that doesn't cut it. The enemy is in control of so many aspects of our American culture, and we, followers of Jesus, are their enemies. They hate our Lord and his teachings, and they hate his followers. Okay, so folks, the more people who get this understanding of the fact that the so-called Judeo-Christian churches are actually the enemies of Christ, they have become the enemies of Christ through the brainwashing activities of the international Jew, that we simply need to keep spreading this message, folks. We cannot hold back. We have to preach it and shout it from the rooftops. Okay, another one from Richard, who has been making progress in his church. He says, "Hello, Eli. I forwarded your link in regard to the Herod family to my pastor, along with the note appended below. Last night he told me that things started to click for him in regard to many of the Pharisees being Edomites. Praise Yahweh. He could not understand why they had such a deep-seated hatred for Jesus, which went beyond the usual explanation that they perceived him as a threat to their position." That's true, but it goes way deeper than that. Of course, it goes back to Genesis 3:15. "He also came to understand what was going on when they declared themselves to be Abraham's seed, while nonetheless claiming that they had never been in bondage to any man. Therefore, he has come to understand that they were Abraham's seed through Esau rather than through Jacob. Praise Yahweh. At that point, I told him that the war between Jacob and Esau was still going on at that time, to which he agreed. Then I told him that the conflict still continues today, but that we would have to have that discussion at a later time." Okay. All right, so folks, this message is starting to bear fruit. We cannot cease from spreading the message of Christian identity. And the fact is, folks, that if we do, we will be reneging on our duty to try to reach out to the lost sheep who are still out there and being attacked by ravenous wolves. They are literally being attacked by ravenous wolves. They don't know it. They think that their pastors are actually good people, when in fact they're actually working for the Antichrist. And this is actually what's going on in the world today. Okay, so now I'm going to continue with the message we started last weekend, and I'm going to focus on the statement made by Rabbi Wise, which is a very, very brief, there's a few words, maybe only 20-word sentence here. And I'm going to quote it again. Rabbi Stephen Wise, the chief rabbi of the United States, and this was his opinion of what happened at the return from Babylon. Quote, The return from Babylon and the adoption of the Babylonian Talmud marks the end of Hebrewism and the beginning of Judaism. That's his opinion, okay? Now, there are several clever lies built in to this statement, because it's not true at all that the return from Babylon marked the end of Hebrewism and the beginning of the Babylonian Talmud. Number one, as I proved last weekend, the returnees under Ezra and Nehemiah under no circumstances changed or innovated the law of Moses. They, in fact, upheld it to the strongest degree, and they kicked out all the Mamzers. They expelled all the men who had married foreign wives. They expelled all the Mamzer children, and they began adopting the laws of Moses, the ritual sacrifices, the whole shot. It was a restoration of the law of Moses, not in any way, shape, or form new innovations by Mamzer Edomites, okay? They resisted this to the bitter end. All you have to do is read the book of Maccabees, 1 and 2 Maccabees, and you will get that entire history of how the Hasmoneans, the house of Judah, the Maccabees, etc., were doing everything they possibly could to maintain their Mosaic culture, okay? So what this little statement here by Rabbi Wise suggests is five very deceptive lies within this one little statement. And first of all, the statement presumes an identity between the Jewish people and the Judahites, and that's false. There is no identity between those two, because what we've been teaching here and what Christian identity is based on is that the Jews are Edomites, at least the Jews of this time period. We know that later in history, the Khazars, the Ashkenazi Jews, joined their ranks, and those Ashkenazi Jews do not even have one single drop of Shemitic, Israelite, or Judahite blood in them. They're total phonies. When they claim that they're Semites, it's like somebody from Australia claiming to be an Israelite of the Old Testament. That's how ridiculous that claim is, okay? And then the Edomites of Judea are the very Canaanites that Yahweh ordered us to exterminate way back in the days of Moses and Joshua. And they have come and usurped our kingdom, and are trying to usurp our inheritance. That's what this is all about, and this is the basic understanding of Christian identity. So, but they want you to believe that they, the modern Jewish people, are the literal Jews / Judahites of the Old Testament. That's a lie, folks. Lie number two, it creates a plausible scenario, but yet false scenario, for the change from Hebrewism, the law of Moses, to Judaism, Talmudism. Now, of course, everybody assumes, and this sounds so natural and so plausible, that the changes would have happened upon the return from Babylon, but they did not. They absolutely did not. And then I would refer anybody who really wants to study this subject in depth to go to my website, anglosaxonisrael.com, and look up in the newsletter section my article entitled The Origin of Talmudism, and this will give you the whole scenario of what really happened in those days and how this statement by Rabbi Wise is absolute nonsense. It's total nonsense. And that Judaism began to take shape much, much later, at least 500 to 600 years later. And the Talmud itself was not actually even completed or finalized in its written form until around 1000 AD. So you cannot place the formation of Talmudism into the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. You simply cannot do that. Okay, that's more Jewish lies. Third lie. Contrary to what he says, the Talmud was not adopted by those who returned. Okay? They did not invent any new laws. They did not create the oral tradition that Judaism is based on. They had nothing, they had no such agenda. There's absolutely no evidence, certainly not in Scripture, that they created such an innovation. Everything in Scripture proves that they simply restored the Mosaic law to its former status. And the reason why Yahweh had them taken captive and put in Babylon in the first place is because they were not obeying his laws. Because this was a punishment. This was a just punishment by Yahweh of his disobedient people. That's what it was all about. And I quoted last week from the book of Jeremiah, which says exactly that, and that the good figs were the ones who accepted the punishment and went to Babylon for the 70 years, and the bad figs were those Judahites who decided, oh, I don't want to be a captive, I don't want to accept this punishment, I'm going elsewhere. Some of them went to Egypt, and they were destroyed in Egypt. Okay? And some of them stayed behind and occupied the area called Samaria today, which was, in fact, the area occupied by the Sepharvaim, the Shelahites, the Cuthites, Edomites, and various other people. And that's how Samaria became a mongrel nation existing between the territory of Judah and the territory of Benjamin. Fourth lie. The Talmud, the written version of the oral traditions and the teachings of the Pharisees, was not encoded until at least, at the very earliest, 500 AD. And even then, it was simply the oral traditions of the rabbis. And in Matthew chapter 23, Yahshua clearly identifies these rabbis as evil men, distorters of his holy word. I'm going to quote Matthew chapter 23, verses 23 through 33. And here he's talking to these rabbis, these Talmudic rabbis, but this was before they had the opportunity to write down their oral tradition, which is Talmudism. That's what we call it today, and that's what they call it themselves. Verse 23, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought you to have done, and not to leave the other undone." In other words, they're focusing on external rituals, and they're totally disregarding the law. That's what he's telling them. Verse 24, "You blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel." Okay? They will pick you apart and tell you how evil you are because you failed to wash your hands before eating your pizza. Okay? But they will kill people for their body parts and sell them on the open market, but that's okay. That's simply fine, according to these rabbis. Okay? That's what he means here. "You blind guides which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye may clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess." This is the gospel, folks. Why aren't the preachers of the Judeo-Christian churches teaching this? "You blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also." But of course, the Jews aren't interested in that, because they're the children of the devil. They love lying, cheating, stealing, and murdering for their religion. Verse 27, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like to the whited sepulchres," that is, tombs, "which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but within you are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say," and then they charge admission for it, right? "And say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore you be witnesses to yourselves that you are the children of them which killed the prophets. Fill you up then the measure of your fathers, which is the Canaanites and the Edomites and the Kenites, and the various tribes of the Canaanites that survived the Noah's flood, the giants, etc. Verse 33, "You serpents, you generation of vipers," and that word means race, "you race of vipers, how can you escape the damnation of hell?" This is Judaism, folks, and I just got bumped off the... Maybe I said those words a little too forcefully, it just bumped me right off the internet, but I trust that you're still able to hear me. So I just want to quickly run down how the house of Judah was changed after the Persian occupation, because all of these things that were done by Ezra and Nehemiah were done by the permission of the Persian Empire. Okay, so the Persian Empire was in great sympathy with the Judahites. Okay, and Yahweh permitted this because this was his plan all along. And it was because of the Persians' sympathies with the Judahites that all of this was possible. So during the Persian period, which roughly is from 517 B.C. to the days of the Greek period, when Alexander the Great invaded the territory, and he first took care of Tyre and the Phoenicians, okay? He took care of them, and then he went to march on Jerusalem. But what happened was he paid a visit to the temple first, and one of the priests there showed him the book of Daniel. And upon showing him the book of Daniel, it reminded him of a dream that he had once had, that he would be standing in this very place, okay? And that this prophecy, he realized that this prophecy was about himself. It was one of the prophecies in the book of Daniel that the Greeks would come and take over the Persian Empire, okay? And so he upon realizing this, he had great admiration for the Mosaic scriptures, and he left Judea without doing any harm to the Judahite people there, okay? So this lasted for a while, and obviously the nation of Judah would have fared much better under his successors had they been really solidly keeping the law, but apparently they were not. After Alexander died, his kingdom was divided into four parts, and the part that took control of the house of Judah was Ptolemaic Egypt. So the Ptolemies took control of Judah after the death of Alexander. And again, even the Ptolemies were very good to the house of Judah. In fact, Ptolemy Philadelphus is the one who ordered the 70 scribes of Judah, not Jews, the 70 scribes of Judah, to write down the Torah and the whole of the Old Testament as we have it today, including the Apocrypha. So the Apocrypha has to be older than 260 B.C., folks. Any scholar who says, oh, well, this is a recent invention or, you know, dates from the time of Christ or just before, well, folks, this happened in 260 B.C., okay? And they wrote it down in Greek because Ptolemy Philadelphus had a tremendous library and he wanted to add the Hebrew scriptures to this library, okay? So that, and evidently they had the book of Enoch as well, but that's been deleted from our scriptures, and Jasher, etc. These have been deleted by you-know-who. They're always the ones trying to distort our history and claim it for themselves. So, but there was a fly in the ointment because the Seleucid kings, who are one of the other of the four successors to the kingdom of Alexander, they began an internal war, a civil war, against the Ptolemies of Egypt. And so during this civil war, Antiochus Epiphanes invaded Jerusalem in 168 B.C., and this is what was responsible for the Maccabean Revolt. As I said earlier, the Maccabees were doing their absolute best, and the Judahites were doing their best. And of course, during this Greek period, that's when the Hellenization began. And so it was during this period of Hellenization where, as today in America, you know, we used to be a Christian country, but today we're a Jewish country because the Judaization of America began with the influx of the Russian Jews, so-called Russian Jews, the Ashkenazi Khazar Jews from the Pale of Russia as they moved in droves to New York City. And it was their moving into New York City that began the corruption of America's morals, the corruption of our institutions, the corruption of our monetary system, and the destruction of our U.S. Constitution. It's all these Jews who moved in from the Pale that were responsible for this. I'm going to be quoting from the Center for Online Judaic Studies and their assessment of how this change took place. Okay, here's what they say. By the early 2nd century B.C., large segments of Judean society, and that's correct, the word Judean is the correct word, not Jewish, okay? Sometimes they are accurate in their usage of words, okay? Large segments of Judean society, especially the priesthood in Jerusalem, were thoroughly acculturated in Greek ways. Now, but you have to understand that the Maccabees were totally opposed to this, and many, many others, not just besides the Maccabees. If it were only the Maccabees, they never would have been able to gather an army to defend Judah, okay? So what we're talking about here is just as we have today between the Democrats and the Republicans, we have the parties that are influenced by money, by Jewish money. These are the Judaizers, okay? Whereas the common people simply follow behind, not realizing what's going on, not understanding that our country is being subverted by these Jewish Zionists, okay? By the early 2nd century B.C., and they, of course, put B.C.E. there, meaning before the Common Era, which is another Jewish invention, large segments of Judean society, especially the priesthood in Jerusalem, were thoroughly acculturated in Greek ways. This soon led to religious and political upheaval. First one and then another priest bribed Antiochus IV, who was Antiochus Epiphanes, the head of the Seleucid Empire, which was based in Syria, and had split rule over the lands of Alexander's empires with the Ptolemies of Egypt, to have themselves appointed as high priest. Okay, so certain individuals of Judah were bribing Antiochus to make them high priest. And this is how the division among the priests began to be taking place. Okay, and I'm not sure what Maui's asking. We need to be inspired for his name. But anyway, what we have, and this was when Antiochus Epiphanes invaded, that's when he sacrificed pigs on the altar. And of course, as we all know, that pork is forbidden to us. And he tried to force, I believe the name was Menelaus of the high priest at the time, tried to force him to eat pork. And he refused to eat pork. And so Antiochus told him, well, just pretend you're eating the pork. And he refused to pretend, so they killed him. Okay? So they killed him. And this is the extent to which the Greeks were going to destroy the temple worship. Okay? So to raise money for these bribes, the aspirants robbed the temple treasury. To make matters worse, in 168 BCE, Antiochus ransacked the temple and placed pagan troops in Jerusalem. Things reached a breaking point in 167 when Antiochus banned key, now they use the word Jewish, which is a deception, key Judahite religious practices and introduced idols into the temple. The reaction to Antiochus' outrages began in the obscure town of Modian on the northwest periphery of Judea and was led by a priest named Mattathias and his five sons, Judah, Simon, Jonathan, Eleazar, and another Jonathan, collectively known as the Hasmoneans, after an ancestor, the family would lead the fight against the Seleucids, and after a quarter-century-long struggle, would assume power and reestablish a Judahite kingdom, not Jewish, for the first time in more than 400 years. But what they mean here is kingdom, where the Judahites had, in addition to a high priest ruling in the temple, they would have another king. But in effect, those high priests served as kings as well. Continuing, at first, the struggle was led by Judah Maccabee. After 3 years of guerrilla warfare against the Seleucid forces, the Hasmoneans succeeded in capturing Jerusalem. They purified the temple and reestablished the sacrifices as ordered in the Torah. This event is still celebrated annually by the Jews as the holiday of Hanukkah. Of course, the Jews were not even present here, because they're not Israelites, they're not Judahites, they're simply assuming our history and pretending to be us. But this is a guarantee here. This proves that the Maccabees and the Judahites of the time were desperately trying to preserve their heritage. And part of that heritage was not making marriages with non-Judahites. Of course, the Jews have no such rule, so they can't be Judahites. And the Jews totally deny the Mosaic Law, so they can't be Judahites. They're imposters, folks. Continuing here. The years that followed, however, were filled with setbacks for the Hasmoneans, including the death in battle of Judah Maccabee. By 152, Two claimants were attempting to seize the Seleucid throne. One of them, Demetrius, turned to Jonathan, then the brother in charge of the Hasmonean camp, for support. Jonathan agreed, but in return was acknowledged as the local ruler of Judea. By 141, Simon, by then the last surviving Hasmonean brother, succeeded in ejecting the remaining Syrian troops. He then declared Judea's independence and reestablished the Judahite monarchy. Simon, 142 to 134 BC, and his successors expanded the borders of the Judahite state north and west to the Mediterranean, north to the Golan, south to Moab, and even east to the Jordan. So again, they actually expanded their state. But apparently, the continuing corruption of the priesthood began this period of time in which corruption began to set in the nation of Judah. So this is really how things developed. There was no such thing. There's no indication here from this history. Now, this is from a Jewish website to suggest that the Jews, or rather the Judahites, okay, they got it trained very well, don't they? That the Judahites began innovating according to the lines of the Babylonian Talmud, okay? So this history from a Jewish website actually proves that the origin of Talmudism, the argument I'm making in the origin of Talmudism, is in fact accurate, okay? So we have this civil war between the Ptolemies and the Antiochians, or the Seleucids. And because of the civil war, and the house of Judah was caught in the middle, okay, and some of the Judahites took sides with the Ptolemies, some of them took side with the Seleucids, and then, this was the period when, some innovations came in, but I would say certainly not among the people, certainly not among the temple priests, but only among those aspiring to be high priest, paying bribes to the occupying forces in order to be high priest. And that would be, in my opinion, the extent to which any innovations took place. And so there was no change in the law. There was no change in the law whatsoever. There is none recorded. Okay? So anybody who tries to suggest that innovations, Talmudic innovations, started to occur during this time period is simply a liar. As the more explicit Jewish history I quoted clearly explains. Okay? So during the civil war between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, then came the Romans, because the Romans began to make war against the Greeks and began to overthrow them. Okay? And this, now I'm going to quote from another historical site. Now, first of all, we have to understand, as I went through the history of John Hyrcanus and Antipater last time, and then that the Romanization of the house of Judah took place under John Hyrcanus and Antipater. Antipater was an Edomite who went to Julius Caesar and bribed him with a lot of money. And this got Antipater, the procuratorship, that is the tax collector position, okay, for the Roman occupation of Judea. And also, this Julius Caesar granted him that one of his sons, Phasaelus, would be the governor of Judah, and that Herod, his other son, would be the governor of Galilee. So this was attained by bribery, folks. This was attained by bribery, and I quoted those passages from Josephus last week. So let me continue here with when Pompey was marching in to conquer the Greeks. Okay, he was making war against both the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Here's what happened. Meanwhile, Antipater married an Idumean named Cypros, by whom he had four sons, Phasaelus, Herod, Joseph, and Pheroras, and a daughter named Salome. While back in Rome, politics were heating up. In an effort to please Julius Caesar, the Egyptians decapitated Pompey. Okay, so while Pompey was invading, the Ptolemies defeated his forces and cut off his head. After Julius Caesar had taken control of Rome, Antipater made himself useful to Caesar in his war against Egypt, Caesar conferred on him Roman citizenship and freedom from taxes. How about that? You pay a bribe, and you don't have to pay any more taxes. He confirmed Hyrcanus as high priest and made Antipater procurator of Judea. As procurator, Antipater made his eldest son Phasaelus governor of Jerusalem and gave Galilee to Herod, who was only 15 years old at the time. Eager to prove himself, Herod helped the Syrians by seizing and slaying a troublesome band of robbers, which made him popular with the Syrians, okay? And these robbers were, I think, Amorites, who were the little people that lived in the hill country and dwelt in caves. And they would come out of their caves and rob the farmers of the territory. And so this was creating real havoc in the territory. And Herod, by doing this, ingratiated himself with the people, the farmers of the territory, okay? Antipater received reflected glory and honor from this. When Hyrcanus wanted to send money to Rome, Antipater offered to take it, but presented it at his own gift, as his own gift. Now, this is how a Jew operates. So I give the Jew money to take to somebody else and say, please deliver this money to this person. And then he goes and says, oh, I'm giving you, this is my money that I'm giving you. It doesn't come from the third party. This is my money. And this is how the Jews ingratiate themselves. In other words, he totally misrepresented what this gift was, okay? And then Flavius Josephus says Hyrcanus knew of this and approved. So Hyrcanus is a really weak character, isn't he? But the leading Jews felt differently, and of course the leading Judahites felt differently, because the citizens of Jerusalem knew that Antipater had stolen this money and misrepresented it as his own money, when that wasn't the case. And they're telling Hyrcanus, how can you let this Jew get away with this? How can you let this Edomite get away with this? They confronted Hyrcanus, telling him that he was king in name only, and that Antipater and his sons had taken over the rulership. Okay? So obviously the Judahites were still trying to preserve their heritage and resented this Edomite taking over. Okay? And this is real history, folks. They accused Antipater's son Herod of having broken their law by executing a man who had not been sentenced to death by the Sanhedrin. Nobody could sentence a man to death without the approval of the Sanhedrin. That's Judahite, Mosaic law, right? Hyrcanus reluctantly had to admit that much, so he ordered Herod to appear before the Sanhedrin. Herod obeyed, but he came with an armed guard, okay? Sextus Caesar, the governor of Syria, asked Hyrcanus to clear Herod of the charges because probably got bribed, right? And somebody saying that they can't hear. Anybody else can hear? Some people have lost audio. Well, let me repeat this. Sextus Caesar, governor of Syria, asked Hyrcanus to clear Herod of the charges. Hyrcanus tried to comply, but the Sanhedrin had other plans, and so when it looked as though the Sanhedrin would pronounce a sentence of death, the Sanhedrin, these are Judahites now. These are not Jews. These are not Edomites. These are Judahites. When they would pronounce a sentence of death, which they were going to. Yeah, I see people can hear. Very good. Hyrcanus advised Herod to escape. That snake, that traitor. Okay? Well, because Hyrcanus was being influenced by Jewish money, by Edomite money. And therefore, he told Herod, okay, they're getting ready to pronounce a death sentence upon you, so get out. Get out of town. Okay? And this is how Hyrcanus conspired with Herod to help the Edomites take over Judah. Herod went to Damascus, where Sextus Caesar made him general of the army of Celesyria. Despite his attempt to help Herod, Hyrcanus was rightly afraid that Herod would then try to make war on him. This is what happens when you help a Jew, folks. Hyrcanus saved his life, and then Herod gathered an army to invade Jerusalem. Antipater and Herod's brother Phasaelus stopped Herod from marching on Jerusalem. Says, you can't do that. The man just saved your life. How can you do that? That'd be too Jewish, right? Back in Rome, Cassius and Brutus headed a conspiracy to assassinate Julius Caesar. Mark Antony and Octavian were allies for a while in their opposition to the assassins, okay? Herod ingratiated himself with Rome when Cassius came to Syria following the assassination of Julius Caesar. Herod did not balk at bringing him the taxes he demanded from Judea, so he became our tax collector. And aren't these things happening today? Who runs the IRS? If not the Edomites? Herod did not balk at bringing him the taxes he demanded from Judea, although other areas resisted, for which reason he was commended and others punished. So obviously, because of the intrigues that were going on, instigated by Antipater and Herod, there was a division being created between the true house of Judah, some taking the traditionalists being those who obey the Mosaic law, and the innovators being the Jews. Let me repeat that. The traditionalists were the Judahites, the innovators were the Jews, okay? Herod became engaged to a granddaughter of Hyrcanus. She was but one of several wives he had by an earlier wife, Doris, married perhaps in 47 BC. Herod had a son also named Antipater. Thus, related by marriage and the friendship of his father Antipater, who had then been poisoned by someone else trying to represent Hyrcanus' interests. Okay, so his father Antipater was poisoned. Hyrcanus told Mark Antony that Herod was the best ruler. Because of this and a bribe, another bribe, folks, Mark Antony made Herod and his older brother Phasaelus tetrarchs. This is the kind of intrigue, skullduggery, and subterfuge that goes on whenever you have Edomites in control of the country. This is true history, folks. Anybody who tries to tell you that Herod was a Judahite is a liar, a plain and simple liar. And, of course, this is the type of history that nobody wants you to know. So, in conclusion of this story here, we want to verify that the house of Judah was doing their utmost to preserve their Mosaic traditions and laws, their absolute utmost. But when you're being invaded on all sides by Greeks, Romans, Idumeans, Persians, and what have you, Arabs, the Arabs were trying to invade Judah as well, and the Samaritans, okay? Now, I have one more thing to say about the Samaritans before I open up the lines. And I want to quote here how Josephus describes the Samaritans. Now, I've already stated that the nation of Samaria, which existed between Judah and Galilee, that in Galilee being the area of Benjamin, that they had started settling there right after the Assyrian captivity, because the Assyrians removed the people of Judah, Benjamin, and the other 10 tribes from their residences there in Palestine and took them north to Armenia, the northern areas of Mesopotamia, and also the eastern areas of Mesopotamia, which would, in ancient days, would have been called Chaldea or Sumer or what have you, okay? But these northeastern areas of the Tigris and Euphrates River, and there they used them for slave labor. That's why they exported them. In fact, it was the Israelites that actually built the city of Nineveh under Assyrian domination. Okay, so again, our people had been enslaved as they were in Egypt, and Yahweh warned them that if they don't obey his law, and this was the 10 northern tribes who were more guilty of this than the house of Judah, that's why they were taken captive first by the Assyrians and placed in Hala and Habor, just south of the Caucasus Mountains. And then when they finally fled, we're getting lost, we don't like being slaves, let's get out of here. They crossed the Caucasus Mountains, and our ancestors became known as the Caucasians. Okay, so the Persian period would last from about 517 to 332 when Alexander invaded. Okay, the Greek period would have lasted from 331 to 167, and that's during this time the Romans invaded and made war against the house of Judah, but the house of Judah tried to maintain their independence, and they did. And the Maccabeans maintained, a treaty relationship. They maintained a treaty relationship with the Romans from about 167 to 63. And then after that, when the Romans finally did totally invade and take over the country, that was around 63 B.C., okay? And this was the days of Herod, because Herod was nothing but an Edomite usurper who was taking over our country and making deals with the Romans left and right in order to enslave the house of Judah. Again, enslaved. But just like today, the people didn't realize, and the number of people who were objecting to this enslavement were too few, and therefore Herod, with his henchmen, was able to take over and put the house of Judah under subjectivity once again. Now, regarding these Samaritans, here's what Josephus has to say about them. And, of course, this is the territory just north of Judea and just south of Galilee. The Samaritans, seeing that Alexander had greatly honored the Judahites, determined to profess themselves Judahites. For such is the disposition of the Samaritans, as we have already elsewhere declared, that when the Judahites are in adversity, they deny that they are of any kin to them, and then they confess the truth, okay, that they are not kinsmen of the Judahites. But when they perceive that some good fortune hath befallen them, they immediately pretend to have communion with them, saying that they belong to them, and derive their genealogy from the posterity of Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, unquote. So here we see that this idea of impersonating Judah arose among the Samaritans, many of whom were Edomites, and of course, the Samaritans and the Edomites made a league on several occasions to fight against Judah. And so we understand that the Samaritans and the Edomites were the true enemies of the house of Judah, and in no way, shape, or form can they be considered our people. They were mongrels in that time, but when it suited their purpose, they pretended to be Judah, and when it didn't suit their purpose, they reverted back to what they really were, Jews, okay? So the Samaritans and the Edomites, being mongrels, pretending to obey the Mosaic law. That'd be another good definition of the word Jew. Someone, not just someone who pretends to be a Judahite, but someone who pretends to obey the Mosaic law and has, in fact, invented their own Talmudic religion and pretending to be a Judahite or an Israelite. I want to do one more quote here, maybe a couple more before I open up the lines. This is from W.G. Finlay, late editor of the periodical The Covenant Message, and he said this about the Jews. According to Josephus, in Antiquities of the Judahites, the name Jew first came into existence with what is generally called the return from the Babylonian captivity. Of course, this is the Jewish story. Actually, Josephus doesn't say that. His translators do, is my comment here. Continuing with Finlay, I find it very significant that prior to this time, the word Jew was unknown. Why, in the Masoretic text, which is a Jewish work, is there no reference to Abraham the Jew or Moses the Jew? This surely tells us something, but so few are prepared to open their eyes and see the depth of the masquerade, which is having such a disastrous effect on the true Israel people. So whenever this masquerade started, it is having a disastrous effect on our people, and we must concede that point. W.N. Saxon, William Norman Saxon, in his booklet, The Mask of Edom, says this, Judaism's masquerade as biblical Judah, and moreover as all Israel, which is the basis of Jewish nationalism, becomes patently counterfeit when placed in juxtaposition with the historical record of the true houses of Israel and Judah. So if you truly understand the real history of the intertestamental period, the real history of our people, you understand that Judaism is a masquerade. Even a brief summary will show the contrast between the descendants of biblical Jacob Israel as opposed to the alien posterity of the cabal, which claims for itself not only the promised land, but the very name and inheritance of Israel. Very well put. Very well put, William Norman Saxon. Okay, now from the book of Psalms, For lo, Thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people, that is us, the true Israelites, and consulted against thy hidden ones. And of course, we are hidden because we don't even know who we are. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. Of course, that's what they said at that time. But since then, they got the brilliant idea of calling themselves Israel and impersonating us. For they have consulted together with one consent. They are confederate against thee. There's a Jewish conspiracy against us, folks. There is a Jewish conspiracy against us, and we have to acknowledge it, okay? Because that's true history. So I'm going to recognize Bavaria Man.
Hi.
Hello. Okay.
Great.
I see you.
Okay.
You've been listening very patiently.
Sure.
Do you have any questions or comments at this point from Germany?
Well, the basic thing is pretty good. Very good.
Okay.
I'm delighted with it. And there was also something. Oh, yeah, the beginning of the thing we were talking about, the Israelites and the people are coming free, and slowly people are coming up to understand what is going on.
Right.
I just had a phone call with the Netherlands.
Netherlands? Okay.
The woman there, I know her very well, and in the Netherlands, she's an editor of various magazines in spiritual things.
Okay.
And she also
editor.
Is very busy in getting the people and the pastors in the Netherlands operational and understanding, and she's doing a great job.
Okay.
So praise Yahweh.
Christian Israel understanding. She's trying to promote this in the Netherlands. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, is she having a problem understanding certain concepts, perhaps?
Maybe she's listening in. I don't know.
Oh, okay,
she,
that'd be great.
If she had the time. Yeah. I don't know the guests here.
Right.
But that's all I wanted to say. That's very good.
Okay. All
appreciable.
Right. Thank you very much. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, talk to you later. Thank you. Okay, let me scoot down on the, number one, which is probably London.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, June. How
Hello,
are you doing today?
Pastor Eli.
Yeah. Do you have a comment or question?
Well, I am enjoying the meeting, but I have my friend Chris with me.
Okay.
Chris P, so he'll probably speak to you as well.
Yeah, Chris, how are you doing today? Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, very interesting what you were saying about the Apocrypha having been, written in Greek in the Greek Bible.
Yes.
And I just wondered whether you knew whether or not it was, similar to the modern Apocrypha, or had there been subsequent additions and deletions?
Well, that's a good question. I think possibly Bill Fink might be able to answer that better if he chooses to call in. Hint, hint, hint. But my understanding is the Greek Septuagint was the document of the Old Testament which was used by Jesus himself and the apostles. Okay? And scholars who are knowledgeable of these things have admitted that there were differences in the quotations derived from the Masoretic text, which is the Jewish version. It's actually a redaction of the Hebrew scriptures. The Jewish authors of the Talmud and of the Masoretic text deleted lots and lots of verses. If I remember correctly, the Masoretic text is only 90% of what the Septuagint is. That's how many verses the Jews removed from the Old Testament. Okay? So that when you compare a quotation from the New Testament of the Old Testament, we find out that it almost always agrees better with the Septuagint than it does with the Masoretic text. And sometimes you don't even find it in the Masoretic text. And the Masoretic text is what our King James Version is based on. Okay? So it's very important. If you have a problem, and this is one of the... I should have mentioned this in my newsletter, that if we have a problem with the translation of the King James, we certainly should go to the original Hebrew and look at the actual definitions of the words to see if these words are being properly used in the context of an Old Testament verse, right? But now sometimes you won't even find the word there. So in which case, that's when we go to the Septuagint and say, well, what does the Septuagint have to say about this issue? Okay, And that's when we find out if the Masoretic has been redacted or has been distorted, because the Septuagint is the real Hebrew Old Testament, but it's written in Greek, okay? And it's much more complete, and as you mentioned earlier, it does contain the Apocrypha, and so did the original King James Version, by the way.
Oh, yes.
The original King James Version did contain the Apocrypha, but they were removed sometime in the 19th century. By whom? It's hard to prove, but in my opinion, it was the Rothschilds who were instigated that. Okay, I see Bill's on the line. Bill, do you have a comment along these lines?
Well, just to say, I might be wrong, but I don't think there is a Hebrew Maccabees.
Okay.
I'm fairly certain that they were written in Greek and only exist in Greek. They're not. They were never a part of the Hebrew.
Okay.
Well, if you want to say the Hebrew Bible.
Okay.
One Maccabees, two Maccabees is sort of like a, I don't know, it's sort of like a redacted one Maccabees.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, it's one Maccabees is the important book of the Maccabees.
Uh-huh, okay.
That's the historical.
Yes.
The original historical account.
Right.
And Josephus drew from it very heavily.
Uh-huh.
And supports it greatly.
Yes.
And one Maccabees is by no means complete.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like Josephus records the letter that the Spartan king wrote to Jerusalem, for instance.
Okay.
Which was, it actually happened just before, that letter was written just before the Seleucid destruction, you know, the Seleucid defilement, I should say, of the Second Temple.
Right, right.
Well, Maccabees records the answer, but of course it doesn't record the letter.
Right.
It's a historical snapshot of that time period.
Okay.
But it's not, you know, it's by no means a complete a complete history of the intertestamental period, by no means.
Oh, of course not.
It's only a historical snapshot of a couple of decades.
Right. But that is what Josephus provides us in spades.
Right.
Yes.
And I would, one Maccabees is very important, but it's only a starting place.
So that letter that you referenced, that is from, I forget now which, it was one of the dispersed Israelite nations.
Well, right, it was the king of Sparta.
Sparta.
And the Dorian Greeks, I assert, come from Dor in Palestine.
Okay.
And I have documentary evidence, and I could point to Homer.
Okay.
To show that the Dorian Greeks were, in his day, they were only on Crete.
Right.
And Homer describes all the tribes and nations of the known world at his time are surrounding Greece, surrounding the Greek city-states, I should say.
Uh-huh.
And Homer never mentions Dorians anywhere but on Crete, and that's in the Iliad.
Okay, okay.
Now, I believe the Crete, you know, was, like for many tribes, a stepping stone between Europe and the Levant.
Okay.
Now,
That would be Asia Minor.
The Dorian king in the 2nd century B.C., yes, he wrote to the high priest Onias at the temple in Jerusalem,
okay,
and claimed the descent from Abraham and the kinship,
yes,
which in a later letter under the Maccabees, a different high priest had surely agreed with.
Yes. So that's...
And knowing the racialism of the people in Jerusalem at the time and how racially aware the original Maccabees were,
right,
it's very clear that they could have never agreed with that. I mean, it's clear,
right,
to me they could have never made such agreement in profession unless it was true.
Right, yeah, and even as late as the days that Jesus walked the earth, they still had the signs on the entrances to the temple that unless you're a true-blooded Israelite, if you go past this line, you will be put to death.
Well, right, but that really, by that time, it was, a circumcised Judean,
right,
was often an Edomite.
Could often have been an Edomite. Exactly, right. So this is, the Apocrypha, therefore, provides proof that the Dorian Greeks of Troy, okay, or the
Dorians of Troy. Don't confuse the Dorians and Troy, please.
Okay.
The Dorian Greeks, the Dorians took over the Peloponnesus from the Danans.
Okay.
From the Danan Greeks in probably the 11th century B.C.
Okay.
And they were, they always talked about the perioikoi, or the people that lived around them. And they, the people that lived around them were almost certainly Danans.
Okay. Oh, did you say Spartans instead of Trojans?
Yes. The Dorian Greeks are represented by, mostly in the Peloponnesus, by the Sicyonians, the Corinthians, and the Spartans.
Okay. I see. Okay. Yeah, so...
Well, that's their biggest, most notable cities, anyway.
Right. So, anyway, we have scriptural evidence connecting some of the Greeks, or Trojans, to the Israelites.
Right, but I know of no Hebrew copy of Maccabees. They were Greek books from the beginning.
Right. So, then, therefore, the Apocrypha, which apparently descend only through the Septuagint and not through the Masoretic text, correct? That would be the case?
Right, and I believe that in the King James Apocrypha, you know, we have Second Esdras in there, and there's no Greek copies of that extant.
Oh, really?
And I believe they got that from a Latin copy.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, I might be wrong about that, but I know I'm not wrong about the fact that there are no Greek copies of 2 Esdras, and you know, we love to point out some of the prophecies in 2 Esdras.
Yes, they're amazing.
You know, the book that we know is 2 Esdras. But yeah. that there are no Greek or Hebrew copies of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the Apocrypha, I mean, some of it, like Tobit, is certainly of Aramaic, you know, language.
Written in Aramaic, okay.
But the Maccabees, the books of the Maccabees are Greek books.
Okay. So is this why...
As language is concerned, not as ethnicity is concerned.
Right. And is this why the Catholic Church and others would call the Apocrypha non-canonical books? Is this why would they... Because they weren't...
Well, if you want to take the position that the word is only handed down in Hebrew before the time of Christ...
Right.
Then that position would necessitate them being excluded from canon.
Right. Okay. Yeah, if that's the rule. But nobody ever cites that as a rule.
Well, right, but it's very, you know, 1 Maccabees is very important historically.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Because, yeah, and I definitely encourage everybody to get a copy of the Apocrypha and read them, especially Esdras and Maccabees, because they're full of historical, and Esdras is full of very, very significant prophecies that cannot be ignored. Yeah. Yeah.
Right, and Second Esdras, you know, it's not found in the Septuagint because no Greek copy is extant.
Okay. So it's only found in the Septuagint.
It's not. Two Esdras is not in the Septuagint.
Okay, so that was added.
There's no Greek copy of it.
There's
so
no
how
Greek
could it be in
it.
The Greek Septuagint?
Oh, okay. So
you know what I mean? There's no extant Greek copy.
I see. Okay. But it's possible there was a Greek version, but only a Latin copy of it remains.
Well, that's a possibility, but I don't know if the Dead Sea Scrolls are silent on 2 Esdras.
Okay.
And I don't know if there's any I haven't studied into it enough, but I don't know if there's any documentary evidence for 2 Esdras in other languages. I don't know.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, Chris, you have any more questions?
I don't know if you know, but it's interesting you mentioned about the Apocrypha having been taken out of the King James,
right?
But at the coronation of, I believe it was George VI, the Trinitarian Bible Society of Great Britain presented the King for his coronation with a very impressive leather-bound Bible, gold embossed.
Okay.
But they rejected it on the grounds that it didn't contain the Apocrypha and that the Apocrypha had to be in the Bible for the coronation.
Very good.
Service.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because who decides that something is canonical or not? You know, and it's very obviously Israelite literature referring to our ancestors, referring to our history, okay, about our people. Okay. Yeah. So who's to say that this information should be rejected and doesn't belong in the Bible? You know, who makes that decision?
But I don't know if you know, but in the, I think it was in the late 1700s, there was a committee set up by the Jesuits called the Removal of the Opiate from the People, and that was the Bible.
Okay.
And the year they disbanded, that was when the Apocrypha was removed from the King James.
Now, what was the name of this committee again? I didn't get that.
The Removal of the Opiate of the People. I've got the name of the book somewhere, but I think it's very difficult to find.
Right. The removal of the opiates of the people.
The opiate of the people.
Religion is called the opiate of the people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. As if it were the opium.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hollywood's the real opiate of the people.
Oh, we love opium. Bill, you were going to say something about that.
Well, Hollywood and mass media, they're the real opiate of the people.
That's right.
Yes.
Not the Bible. Yeah. And, you know, if the Bible were the opiate of the people, they wouldn't be trying to take it away from us all the time, right?
And, well, nobody's trying to rip Debbie Does Dallas out of your fingers.
right. Yeah.
It's the ways of God replaced by the ways of Satan.
Yeah, yeah.
And when people, when you cut through all the garbage, and you see, that argument is clearly true. It's incredible.
Yeah, so Chris, let me ask you, what is the presence in the Anglican Church or in Britain at all of the King James only adherents who say, well, you must adhere to the translation of the King James, and to hell with the Greek, the original Greek and Hebrew? Do you get much of that in Britain?
Well, I mean, one time all the Anglican churches, you know, went on the King James, but all. I think since the last 20 years, the King James has been thrown out of most of the churches, and
really?
The NIV. And also, I don't know if you've heard of the Book of Common Prayer.
Yes, I've heard of it, yes.
That's also been done away with, although it's still on the statute book as being the... for the order of the service of the Anglican Church, but they substituted it, I forget what they call it now, but...
Alternative services.
Yes, and of course in the Book of Common Prayer, it's all the time referring to us being his people, Israel.
Yes.
So that's probably one of the reasons why it had to go.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I understand Queen Elizabeth the First, when she addressed... her navy, an army or a military, whatever it was, she addressed them as sons of Israel.
Oh yes.
So she understood. She understood that the Brits are Israelites.
Yes. Well, this is why that committee wanted to remove the opiate of the people,
right?
Because the people in that day knew the Bible.
Yes,
and they knew the truth.
Yes,
and that was what it went.
Right.
They
right.
wanted rid of that because they claimed that it was influencing the people, wasn't it?
Yes.
And they want to do the influencing. They don't want the Holy
right.
Scriptures to be filling
right.
us in.
Yes, yes. And the newsletter I put out during the week, I cited here in America, the various newer Bible societies were actually set up by the Rothschilds and by communists. And by socialists and by Gnostics, okay, that,
right.
That they wanted to change the language, and certainly it culminated with the Scofield Reference Bible, in which his notations, it's like if I put a Bible and made notes all the way around the edges and published that, okay, and misled everybody that this is what this verse means and this is what that verse means. That's what Scofield actually did. And his reference Bible is used by all evangelicals, the Dallas Theological Seminary and Moody Bible Institute here in Chicago, and many other theological institutions use that fraudulent Bible as their reference book. Okay? Mm-hmm. And this is the reference book which equates the Jews with Israel. So that idea began to be made popular like in the mid-1850s, with these Bible distorters, with these Bible societies financed by the Edomites in order to dupe the Christian world into believing that the Jews, these Edomites, are in fact Israelites. This is how this idea began to be put into our minds. Okay? And so, Bill, let me ask you, you know, your familiarity with the King James, you know, and we've been talking about on our various nightly shows about how the translations in the King James are defective. So, what would you tell people now that we have this understanding? how should they read the King James in order to overcome this deception?
Well, if you understand the word Jew as always referring to a citizen of the Roman district of Judea,
okay,
because that was a multicultural nation of Canaanites, Edomites, and Judah and Benjamin.
Yeah, and Samaritans, some cases.
Well, right, and the races brought into Samaria by the Assyrians and the Babylonians.
Right.
So we have a multicultural state. We don't have people of any, you know, particular ethnicity, and certainly not, most of them are not of the ancient Israelites.
Yes, yes.
Even though a good portion of them are.
Yeah.
So what we have is just because one is a Jew does not make one an Israelite.
Right, and we have the same situation today in America and Britain. A Brit can be a Muslim from Arabia.
Now, once you understand that the Gentiles of Paul's epistles, as Paul explains in many places, such as 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Romans chapter 4, Galatians chapters 3 and 4, yeah, they are the nations, not Gentiles.
Yes.
They're not non-Jews.
They are,
as Paul explains in Romans chapter 4, the nations descended from Abraham.
Right.
And once we identify those nations descended from Abraham and understand the term Gentiles in that context,
right,
and understand the term Jew in the context that Judean meant in the first century.
That's right. That's
and
what
a resident or inhabitant of multicultural Judea.
Right.
And there's, you
yes.
know, Josephus and Strabo, and there's much testimony
yes.
to that.
Yes.
Well, then you could understand the King James Version of the Bible, and I would recommend the King James Version of the Bible
sure.
above the NIV any day.
Definitely.
And,
okay.
And yeah, you know, most of these modern translations, I mean, there's a couple that have a lot of readings that are good.
Yeah.
Well, like the NASB, it's pretty fair in most of its readings.
Okay, yeah.
And there are some verses that are screwed up throughout Judeo-Christianity and are screwed up in every version of the Bible.
Right.
And I could contend with those. One,
yeah.
I'm sorry, 2 Thessalonians 3, 2, I think, is one of my favorites.
Okay.
And 1 Corinthians 16, 20 or 16, 22, the Anathema Maranatha clause. Yeah,
oh,
you know,
right. Yeah,
there are some clauses that are difficult to understand that all Judeo-Christianity has screwed up.
Yeah.
And they're
going to
be screwed up in every edition of the Bible.
Right.
And that started with the King James,
yeah.
or it may have started before that.
Yeah. So
now,
go ahead.
But basically, the King James, once you understand the terms Jew and Gentile as in their proper first century context and in their proper biblical context,
yes.
Well, then the King James is probably better than 90% of
yeah.
the modern translations.
So what I teach is that as far as the usage of the word Jew in the Old Testament is always fraudulent because it can never mean anything but Judah, because in the Old Testament it was not a multicultural state. It was the house of
not.
Judah. It was the people of Judah. So in the Old Testament, it must mean Judah and nothing else.
Right.
So when you
Judah or Judahite
or
Judahite,
you
know,
exactly.
A person of Judah.
Yeah. So when you're reading the Old Testament, simply scratch out the word Jew, replace it with Judah or Judahite, and then you have an accurate translation. Okay. Because that word does not need to be translated, shouldn't be translated into word Jew, which, as you're correctly identifying, means a multicultural group of people, which the Jews are today, okay? And that's correctly applied to the nation of Judea around the time of Christ, when it had become a multicultural state. Okay.
Well, absolutely, but
yeah.
Judea was it was a Roman-designated political entity
yes.
that included Samaria and Edomia.
Right.
And that's right on, I mean, that's mentioned in Wikipedia even. If you look up Herod Archelaus on Wikipedia and read the third paragraph, and it will admit that Judea included Edomia.
Right, right.
And the Edomites were the eternal enemies of the Israelites.
Right, and that was the great sin of John Hyrcanus when he conquered Idumea.
And Josephus admits that ever since they were considered nothing other but Jews.
That's right.
But Judeans.
Judeans, exactly. So, yes.
So this history is blatantly clear. It's right out there in front of
yeah,
everybody.
If anybody would but read it, but of course the Jews don't want us to know this history because it refutes their claim to being Judah.
Well, the Jews are Yeah, no, they react very vehemently to anybody that repeats this history.
Of course, they're the ones who are trying to cover it up.
They go into denial. I've had Jews tell me, "What are you, crazy? The Edomites disappeared." And my response is that, yeah, the Edomites disappeared. They disappeared right into being Jews.
That's right. They became citizens of Judea. Right. Yeah, Chris, did you was getting ready?
There was just one other point. I expect Bill will be familiar with it, but I don't know if you know. There was another item that was removed from the King James, and that was the translator's preface. I'm not talking about the main preface to the King himself.
Okay, the
there was a translator's preface, and it made sort of allusion to the Greeks being Israelites.
Ah,
and I rather suspect that was the reason it was removed.
Uh-huh. Okay, I don't think I've read that translator's preface. Bill, you have a comment on that? That the translators, the original translator's preface of the King James identifies the Brits, the Europeans?
No, I've never had an original King James. I'm sorry, I've never had the luxury.
Well, somebody just gave me one. I'll have to see if that's in there.
I've got a copy on my computer.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't you send that to me, I'll distribute it to my newsletter, because I'm sure our people will be, love to read that.
My standard is the Nestle Aland Novum Testamentum Grece 27th edition, the NA 27.
Okay.
That's a monument to
proper Greek
hard clerical work is what
okay.
It is.
Yes.
Because it shows all the different variations and all the major manuscripts and papyri of the New Testament. And everything else to me, that's my, I could take the Codex Sinaiticus is available online and several of the papyri read it. They're available online. I could take them and work with them.
Yes.
But the NA 27, it's nice to be able to verify the NA 27 with those works that are available online.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's the
core of my studies in the New Testament.
That would be the
scholarly. And everything
reference.
Else is peripheral. And what the King James translators thought 1,500 years later,
uh-huh.
or what Calvin thought, or what Coverdale thought, that's all peripheral.
Yes.
It's
opinions. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So the NA 27 should be our proper source. In the newsletter I circulated this week, I quoted the Westminster, I forget to call it the Westminster, not the Confession, but the standard for revising translations. And in that statement, they said that the proper method of revising a translation is only by reference to the Hebrew in the Old Testament and the original Greek in the New Testament. They consider these two sources to be inspired, not the translation.
Well, right, and my translation notes are not online.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are glimpses of my translation notes online. Yeah, in some of the papers that I had wrote that Clifton published, like translating Luke 16:16-18, or translating John 1:11-13,
uh-huh.
and they are drawn from my translation notes.
Yes, yes.
Papers.
So you have to know the history and the agendas of people who are translating from the Hebrew and Greek.
Well, right,
yes.
Someday I'll put my translation notes online. I'm sure I will.
Yes.
But and that's a huge task too.
Right. Right.
But
yeah.
But the notes to my translation, my Luke translation has 2,550 footnotes.
Okay. it sounds like a kind of a Schofield version.
well, that's just for Luke's and Acts.
Yeah.
And most of those footnotes, I would say that maybe a third of those, I'm guessing off the top of my head, maybe a third of those footnotes are historical references.
Right.
And
right.
The other two-thirds
yes.
are explain variations in the manuscripts or reasons why my translation diverges so much from the King James or
right.
other.
Right. They're usually grammatical and historical reasons.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Very good. Very good. Okay, so let me just do one more quotation here, and this is from the footnote of the translator, William Whiston, on this subject here of King John Hyrcanus making Idumeans citizens of Judea. This is how he puts it. This account of the Idumeans admitting circumcision and the entire Jewish law, which he calls Pharisaic, okay? So this is historically wrong. There was no such thing as a Pharisaic law yet, okay? But that's what he calls it. The entire Jewish Pharisaic law from this time or from the days of Hyrcanus is confirmed by their entire history afterwards. Ammonius, a grammarian, says the Jews, and it's properly Judaites, are such by nature from the beginning, whilst Idumeans were not Judaites from the beginning, but Phoenicians and Syrians, but being afterwards subdued by the Judaites and compelled to be circumcised and to unite into one nation and be subject to the same laws, they were called Jews or Judeans henceforth. Okay? So this history is out there. It's out there. People understand that the Idumeans were incorporated into the nation of Judah and henceforth called Jews or Judeans, properly called, okay, historically. Accurate term would be
and his, you know, Whiston's reference to Pharisaic law, we tend to, you know, people tend to believe that the Pharisees are the priesthood.
Yes.
And the Pharisees aren't the priesthood. They're a political party who became a large faction in the priesthood.
Yes. Okay.
But they're not, you know, there's priests that are Sadducees and there's priests that are neither.
Right.
And there's probably many priests that are neither.
Right. And we had the Sadducees and the Essenes and other sects as well.
You know, I think it was Thucydides that I read it in, that when the Essenians had actually banned all political parties.
Okay.
Because it created sects that had more, that gained more power than even their actual numbers.
Right, yeah. And that's what was happening in Judea. In
those absolutely.
Days. There was so much infighting among the sects that it was tearing the nation apart. Yes. And we're seeing that happening in America today. We're seeing it happen in Britain. We're seeing it
happen the founding fathers read Thucydides, and they too wanted to ban political parties.
Interesting.
There were many founding fathers of this nation who were against the formation of political parties.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and this would be why. Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting.
Well, what you have is the tail wagging the dog.
That's right.
You know, you right. you have a look at the Republican Party today. I mean, the average Republican in the street would have never wanted John McCain to be the nominee.
Right.
But it was the fat cat Republican party hacks sitting in their county offices and state offices, and they wanted to make wheel and deal, and they wanted John McCain to be the nominee.
Yeah.
And that's an example of the tail wagging the dog. It's only a small one, but it's happened a million times in our political system where unscrupulous people, by unscrupulous means, rise to the top.
Right.
And that's the party system that does that.
Unfortunately, Britain has the same system. The Tories used to be traditionalists, but now they're Zionists, just as the Labour Party is. One's worse than the other. Okay, well, thank you, Chris and June and Bill, for joining me. And I believe it was Wolfgang in Germany. I forget whether it was Wolfgang or Matthew.
Matthew.
Matthew. Okay, it's Matthew. Thanks for calling in. And this is tremendous history. Our people need to know this history. Otherwise, you know, people without a history is lost, and we need to rediscover our history, and that is what the Christian identity movement is all about, for we white Christian Israelites to rediscover who we are. And if we ignore our history, we are lost. My people is destroyed for lack of knowledge, and we have to have this knowledge to understand who we are. So thank you all for joining us, and I'll be back next Sunday, okay, you know, and then Friday, Bill and I are going to do another show on John, and then Saturday, Bill will do a solo show because I'm going to have a public event to attend. Okay? So thank you all for listening. Praise Yahweh, and Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Yahweh bless.
Okay, Yahweh bless. Bye-bye.